Welcome to the Education Investment Podcast. In a world where investors are looking for stable and growing long-term returns with social impact, the education sector is becoming increasingly attractive. We speak to leading educators, operators, and investors in the education sector around the world to explore this growing investment theme alongside our listeners. From preschools to K-12 schools to higher education and vocational education, from edtech to education infrastructure, from VC investors to private equity and family offices, we explore it all. I'm your host, Monde Ngosi. Education has always been a big part of my life because my mother founded a school which was across the road from our home. I have benefited from excellent schools and teachers in South Africa and the US. I went on to study education and I'm now very grateful to be an investor in the sector that I love.
All opinions expressed by podcast guests are solely their own opinions. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions.
Today, I'm privileged to host Pierre Dubuc for a conversation on online education. We'll explore online education and entrepreneurship from Pierre's unique vantage point as co-founder of one of the world's leading companies in online education. We'll also discuss their social impact and find out what Pierre is excited about in the future of innovations in online education. Pierre is co-founder and CEO of Open Classrooms, a leading provider of online education globally. Open Classrooms is headquartered in France and serves over 300,000 students from over 200 countries. The company is backed by leading investors, including General Atlantic, Lumos Capital Group, Salesforce Ventures, and the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative. Pierre is also a founding member of the EdTech Founders Club. He holds a Master of Science in Telecommunications Engineering from the National Institute of Applied Sciences of Lyon. Pierre, it's wonderful to have you on. Welcome to the pod.
Thank you so much. I'm excited.
Great. So before we get on to online education, I'd first love to learn a bit about you, about Pierre. So please tell us a bit about your journey. Where did you grow up? A bit about your family and ultimately what attracted you to education?
Yeah, of course. So I was born in France, in Normandy, the northwest of France. I grew up there until the age of 10. Then my family moved in the southeast of France, in Provence, a nice region, where my mom started building a bed and breakfast. So we lived there in the countryside, a tiny little town of 1,800 people. This is where I grew up. Then I went to Lyon, as you said, to college, and did my undergrad and postgrad there. Did also some studying in Sydney, Australia. Lived in Paris, so that's kind of the short answer.
That's fascinating. And I'd love to first just learn a bit more about your family. So you mentioned that your mom ran a B&B. What did your father do? Did you have any siblings in the house? A bit more color on your family.
Yeah, absolutely. So my mom raised three kids. So I have two siblings, older sister and older brother. When we moved to Provence, like we moved to an old farm that we'd renovated for many years. It was an amputated for like dozens and dozens of years. It's definitely like ruins, essentially. So it was a lot of work. And then we built this amazing place with five guest rooms. So it was very, very busy in summer, you know, from May to September. We'd always have guests around, and we would live in the same house as the guests. So like a very traditional bed and breakfast situation. My dad used to be an accountant, so he became CFO of a small business in the wine industry, because this is also a wine region.
Has that love of wine passed over to you?
Yes. We used to have a lot of wine bottles in our cellar, about like 1,500 bottles, I think, at home. So it's a very, very French cliche, I think.
Okay. No, that's lovely. Look, I hope you've carried some of that across to the US where you are today for this call. Okay, and just staying there in your childhood, I'd love to know, what do you consider some of the most formative experiences of your upbringing?
I think it was this move to Provence, where you know my family decided to build this project. It really started like my grandparents had kind of a bed and breakfast situation already in Normandy. My mom liked that and she wanted to like build her own thing. So it was actually a big project, like probably a bigger project than my parents really could chew, I think. So it took them like a few years to really get to the other side of it. As a kid, you know, we, like the three of us, like participated in like kind of the renovation of the house and all of the hardships that they went through, to build this business, which eventually was successful. But I think it was quite hard, for a few years. So it was really an interesting journey and kind of potentially something that could have passed on to my entrepreneurship journey later on, like this, you know, idea of like working hard and persistence, entrepreneurship, really building something from scratch. So it was definitely quite formative. It was between the age of like 10 and 15.
Okay, well, that's wonderful training for an entrepreneur.
Exactly.
And by the way, my view is that all great things start because you have a goal, you start, you get going, and then you only realize once you're in it just how hard it is. But you already started, so there's no quitting. So well, I find all great things follow that way in some way, whether a physical activity like a marathon or you know starting a business. Okay, and just outside of work, some of your main interests. So you've mentioned one, which is wine, but any other main interests outside of your work?
Yeah, I do a lot of sport and outdoors. So I'm a rock climber. And I started climbing actually when I was in Provence, in southeast of France. So I do all sorts of rock climbing, bouldering, alpine climbing, mountaineering, ice climbing, skiing, ski touring, all of those things. So I do that. I do that a lot. And traveling also. You know, this year, been to Peru for 3 weeks, where I climbed big mountains over there as well in the Andes, and yeah, that's definitely high on the list for me.
That's absolutely wonderful. The only person who must be upset about that is the insurer who manages your life.
Yeah,
insurance.
They're a little bit fickly about it. I don't know why, but they send me those long forms about like how high do I climb? Do I climb with a rope? And you know, it's really
What do you mean you don't know why, Pierre? It's such a dangerous sport. That's why.
I don't think that's dangerous. Actually, you know, it's risk management.
No, that's lovely. Thanks for sharing on those. I think the only one we share, or the ones we share among those, are the traveling and the wine of the set that you described.
Nice.
So another thing then that I'm keen for, just two questions, additional questions on your background still before online education. So a successful career like yours from the outside often can look like a straight line, like, you know, just everything went well and it was a straight line. But we all know that in real life, it doesn't happen like that. There's a lot of ups and downs. So I've heard you talk, you know, before about a dinner you had in Paris with your co-founder, Mathieu, which was quite foundational, where you considered throwing in the towel. Please tell us a little bit about that dinner and, almost equally importantly, what made you persevere and not throw in the towel?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? I think we had like a few moments like this. This one was kind of foundational, like you said. It was more than 10 years ago, about 12 years ago, I think. And at this time, we wanted to switch the business, which was a freemium model based on advertising, towards something more education related, and like build something more ambitious as well. But we had like so many issues. We had the wrong team. We were not global enough. We're not perceived as an education platform, but we're perceived as an IT platform because we were teaching IT at this stage only. It felt like honestly impossible to solve. So it was really daunting. And we had this dinner, Mathieu and I, and we're like, okay, this is over. I mean, we try our best. The subject of the dinner was, how can we write it down, essentially? Like, how do you close a company? And we spend like time discussing that, like, okay, what are the next steps, like the different actions and tasks that we need to do, like, what do we tell, like, how do you do, like, concretely, you know? And the more we talked about it, then like slowly the conversation evolved into like, why are we doing that? Like, could we like put the same efforts towards like kind of changing the situation in a more favorable way, in something we're more excited by? And like, what does it take? What would it take for us to be in a much more positive situation? And then like slowly the conversation kind of slided towards that. And at the end of the dinner, we're like, okay, actually we could do this. And then we felt like that's the better option for us. It's really interesting because that really happened like kind of silently, I would say. And we've seen that, I think, several times in the history. You're so close of throwing the towel. And I think, you know, it's really like when I'm asked like what made the difference, and you know, like people want to hear, oh, it was like the mission, it was my self drive, it was my, you know, it's like something really like a higher power or something.
Yeah.
When frankly, I think it's like 1 inch away, and it could have gone like the other way, quite frankly. So it's really interesting that we can really track that down to the very single reason, and it's all about the details. And I think you're right, like most like great successful entrepreneurship journeys really boil down to, did you quit? And if the answer is no, then that's how you build something like long lasting and successful. Like, that's, to me, the main difference is you didn't quit.
That's wonderful. Some great lessons embedded in that as well. I'd love to, just staying on a sort of similar topic with you and Mathieu. You two are co-founders and you've built Open Classrooms together. So just from your experience and your journey, just in that co-founder relationship, what advice would you have to other young founders on their co-founder relationship?
I think what worked really well for us is to build our relationship and invest in the relationship very intentionally. So one thing that we started very early on is every 6 months, we took an entire weekend, just the two of us, for about like 3 days, just the two of us every 6 months, where we would go like somewhere kind of up the grid. And we would talk about where we are in our personal journeys, like family, relationships, like what are our worries or excitements and so on. And then talk about the business. Where are we? Where do we want to go? Are we excited by our daily jobs and things like that? So it was a great way to realign together every 6 months, because you know, you walk hard, and even if you meet like every day, every week, like you start having like a slight misalignment because people are on their own journey and you have like different wishes and so on. So every 6 months, it felt like the day after this weekend, we're fully aligned, like 100% aligned. And then every week we started being slightly misaligned, like by 1 degree, 2 degrees, 3 degrees.
Yeah.
And every 6 months we managed to like reinvest intentionally. And it worked really well for us. So it definitely something that was key to our success of, you know, making sure that the association, the two of us, really worked over the long term. And we've been working together for more than 20 years, which is exceptional. And I've seen like so many teams of founders where after a few years, you know, you have like different ambitions and wishes, and at some point it just blows up. And that's actually a really good reason for the company to blow up, because, you know, if the founding team, if the top management doesn't agree, then it's really hard to be successful.
That's a wonderful lesson. 20 years or over 20 years that you've been working together. That is, I think, just on over double the average marriage length.
Exactly. It's like a marriage, right? You need to invest in it. You need to spend this time and like build it up. So,
yeah. So that's splendid. That's wonderful lessons there. So thanks for sharing on that, on both your and Matthew's relationship and journey, as well as your own journey and your family. I enjoyed that and learning a bit about you and your journey. So I think let's move on then to some of the main topics for discussion in online education. I think let's start right at the beginning. What is Open Classrooms and why did you and Matthew start it?
So Open Classrooms today, it's an online platform where we teach tomorrow's skills and tomorrow's jobs. Essentially, we target underserved populations to make education accessible. So that's our mission. We're a mission-driven company. The mission is to make education accessible. And we're focused on education leading to jobs. So it's very career-oriented. We want you to have a really significant socioeconomic impact. Get your first job, get promoted, switch careers, get a quality job. On your way, you're going to get a degree, an associate, a bachelor, the master's degrees that we award because we're a college, we're accredited. And we teach in a very different way, in a way that is non-traditional, non-academic. So it's project-driven, it's competency-based. We offer one-on-one mentorship. And we help you find a job, either from day one or at the end of your program, depending where you are on your journey in your career. So that's what we do now. But back then, when we started, and Matthew actually started this project in middle school in 1999, when he was 13 years old, and he wrote a first course to teach others about creating a website. So it was programming in HTML. And he couldn't really find great resources back then in France, in French. And in 1999, the internet was a different place, right? So you couldn't find like amazing like platforms with videos and YouTube and so on. So he built one of the first online courses in French about coding. And Matthew is really gifted about teaching. He's a great teacher. So he built the courses that we wish we had in school. Then I started helping him from 2001. And for many years, we did that parallel to our studies in middle school, in high school, in college. It was not a company. It was not, you know, generating any revenue at first. And it was really just the intent of helping people and building courses that we thought were cool and nice and accessible and the best courses we could build. From there, we built this online learning community where we taught programming, coding in French. And after a few years, it became the reference platform to learn coding in French, in French countries, French-speaking countries. So it's kind of, think about a mix of Khan Academy and Codecademy in the U.S. In French-speaking countries. So we're in college, and we realized that around us, many of our colleagues in France were actually using our platform in school in replacement of their own like classes because they thought it was just better. They didn't even know we were behind it, which was quite funny. And at this stage, we had like this conversation of what do we do with it at the end of our college? Do we continue it? Do we make it a full-time job? And this is what we decided to do, to build a company out of it. And we went on after our graduation and build Open Classrooms as it is today. And at this stage, it was also a really interesting kind of pivot because one of our teachers told us, but you know what, like if you became a school, you would have so much success. And to us, it was really weird to think that way because we thought a school, we identified the school as, you know, brick and mortar, college campus with a stadium, a library, and all of those things. So like, what are you talking about?
History.
Like, this is not what we do. We do online courses, you know, and this is not what we want to do. And we didn't at this stage like realize that we could build a school that was very different. But where it was right is we had so many students and users telling us, I learned everything through your platform, but I'm still enrolled at my university because I want a degree. That's the only reason I'm staying. And I said, but if we teach everything, that's kind of unfair. Like, can we deliver the degree? And this is how we started like talking to the French state and saying, could we get accredited, essentially? Could we deliver online degrees? And at this stage, online degrees were not a thing in France. It had never been done online. It was just in person. And we convinced the French state to be the first ones to deliver an online degree. We did that about 12 years ago. And then we became a college, and this is kind of how we started this Open Classrooms, this journey.
That's wonderful. Great founding story. And there's a lot of themes as well that came through as you were speaking. One of the ones which you mentioned right at the beginning was online education for tomorrow's jobs, which I found quite interesting. So I'm keen to hear about some of the content that you talk about, for instance, when you think about tomorrow's jobs. Some of the other themes that came through were targeting also underserved populations. Also, I'd love to double click on that, as well as the differences in pedagogy that you've gone with. So a lot of topics that I'll also come back to a bit later and dive deeper into, but thanks for that sort of overview. So if I just take what you've described now, it sounds then as though Open Classrooms as an online education provider, an online college, if I use that word, there'd be quite a lot of entities in that ecosystem. You know, you've got the student, you've got employers, because you mentioned that you help the students get a job at the end of this. There'd be public authorities, so quite a lot in your ecosystem. So maybe just starting with a fairly straightforward, a simple question: who do you consider as your client or your customer?
So we have potentially three clients. The student can pay by themselves. Mm-hmm. That's actually the minority of our revenue right now, B2C. So self-paying students, it could be the employer paying to train their own employees or hire new employees. And it could be the government, so public funding streams. We do those three categories, but the main client for us in terms of who is paying is the employer. This is where we generate most of our revenue in B2B. But we do B2C, B2B, and B2G. Of course, in terms of social impact, the student outcomes drive most of the social impact in terms of who do we train to get, they get a degree, they get a good job, they were unemployed, now they have like a high-paying job, etc. But it is also a social impact towards employers and governments. So employers, you know, will have the talent they need, will diversify their workforce, will create value, more business, would be more efficient, more productive, etc. Same on the government side. We managed to train unemployed populations and get them back to a job. So it means more taxes, less unemployment benefits for the government. So you can also analyze that and demonstrate the ROI towards students, employers, and governments.
Okay, understood. So all three. So it wasn't as simple a question as I thought then.
It was not a simple question, All three, the main one being employers.
Got it. So both B2C, B2B, and B2G. Thanks for clarifying that. And maybe just to make it tangible, then let's make it real. No single story, student or client story, will ever be representative, obviously, of all your base. So I'm not asking for a representative story, but a memorable story. Just take one memorable story that you've got. Why did the student come to Open Classrooms? What did they study, and what has it done for their life?
Yeah, I'll give you two quick ones. One in France. We had this testimonial from a dad of one of our students who came to share his story to the Open Classroom system. And he came because his son was in jail for drug use. And what he in jail, like, he wanted to get out with a job, good education. He could not really access to quality education this way. It's very complicated. But he managed to actually study on open classrooms while in jail, being funded by the government at the same time. And he really fought through this journey, managed while in jail with the help of his dad to find an apprenticeship program and graduate, get a job, get back on track. And it was such an emotional story. Like, the dad was literally like crying in front of us because, like, it felt that we indirectly like helped so much his family, his son, to get back on kind of a more stable, more integrated life. That's one example. The second example I'll give you is in the US. Amazing story. Like, honestly, I'm still having like goosebumps thinking about it, because, you know, you have like people really sharing those stories that are, it's so important to them. Usually we come at a moment in time in their life where there is a very deep transition. So it's a very important moment. They're switching careers. They're taking a bold risk. They want to get out of the situation and like have a great socioeconomic impact. That's what they're looking for when they come to us. So the flip side is so important that people are like quite, you know, emotional about it. And, you know, if you do something wrong, then it can blow up very quickly. But the impact is obviously tremendous. So we're very lucky to have this impact with people. And the second example is in the US, we had one day a B2B event about apprenticeship in New York City, where I live. And so we had this event in near Central Park, and we brought a bunch of employers and like high profile leaders and had this like conference and so on. And we brought apprentices who are in, you know, working with some of our employers, studying with us. And I remember I met this young lady who told me, I'm hired right now by Merck, one of our employer partners, a big pharma. She was following a digital marketing program. I asked her, like, where do you come from? I come from the Bronx in New York. And she told me, like, oh, it's the first time I come to Central Park. Wow. And this is, it's kind of a simple detail, but it's like, oh, but you come from the Bronx. And it's like, you know, access to this like world was not a thing. So she couldn't have access to education because she came from a family where, you know, she couldn't go to college. College is very expensive in the US. So from the age of 18, after high school, she had to work like $15 an hour jobs. And, but she was very driven. She's like super smart. So she found this apprenticeship with Merck, and then from there got promoted several times. And now, you know, she makes six-digit salary, and she's a rising star at Merck. It's exceptional, like the impact that we can have in just 1, 2, 3 years on people with a strong will and, you know, hardworking, smart. It's unbelievable.
That is absolutely phenomenal. And yeah, both very different stories, and yet both very, very impactful. So thanks for sharing those, and both obviously on other sides of the Atlantic as well. So geographically very widespread too. So yeah, thank you. That was really great and made it tangible. I'd love to know then, just sort of carrying on this theme, what are some of the areas that would be different about studying at open classrooms versus a traditional college? Is the time still the same? Is it, call it, you know, 3 or 4 years to a junior degree and then a master's, or is there something different there? The actual learner experience, just give me a feel for some of the things that are different that you do.
So it is quite different. It is accelerated. So you're going to get your degree in usually a faster time frame than like 4 years for bachelor's traditionally in the US. It's accelerated because our timetable as a university is not like 15, 20 hours of class for a few weeks, then you have a term, then you have like spring break, and then you come back, and then you have like summer break, etc. No, typically you'll work every day, 5 days a week, like 35 to 40 hours. So it's quite condensed, it's accelerated. You learn online. It is a pedagogy that we call competency-based. So we're going to teach you the skills you need to find a great job. So it's very skills-oriented. To demonstrate your skills, you're going to have projects, so practical projects. There are case studies. So it's very practical. And it's about 80% practical, 20% theory. So projects are, you know, if you want to become an accountant, you'll have to build this balance sheet. If you want to become a software developer, you'll have to code an application. If you want to become, you know, a cybersecurity expert, then imagine there is a hacker and they, you know, intrude the network. And what do you do? What is the investigation process, et cetera, et cetera. You'll be mentored by an expert in the field every week on a one-on-one basis. So yeah, I have this cybersecurity expert from this company with years of experience coaching you throughout the program, helping you out, motivating you. They're a coach to you, but they're also an expert in the field. And then you'll have to defend your project in front of an assessor in a defense session that is recorded in video as a proof of your competencies. This is how we validate competencies. It's also a great portfolio for future employers, because you could show that to employers when you build your defense session, etc. And then at the end, when you validated all of your projects, you'll go to a final jury, you'll get your degree this way. So it could be an associate's, a bachelor's, or master's degree. And we'll help you find a job. So this is how we do it. So I'd say quite different from traditional university. It's online competency-based education. It's mastery learning. So you only go on to the next project when you fully mastered your skills. So we don't have really like grades. We want you to validate skills. So it's a very different mindset.
That's absolutely fascinating. And a lot of things I agree with there that have needed change in our higher education system for quite a long time. One that I'm interested in, so just tangibly, how does it work? Do I have a cohort that's going along this course with me that will finish at roughly the same time? Or can we move ahead, you know, behind others based on our mastery of certain concepts and how fast we go?
So we have the two models. I would say most of our students will go at their own pace. So you'll have an average duration of your program, say 12 months. Some people will complete it in 9 months, some people will take 15 months. So it's very flexible. And you will make progress at your own pace. You'll have, you know, access to an online community where you can work together and, you know, ask questions, etc. But if you want to take a break, go faster, go slower, then you can. It's very individualized, also with the help of this one-on-one mentorship every week that we can, you know, kind of accelerate and slow down depending on your needs. We also have a more cohort-based model, especially with employers when they want to train, you know, 25 people of the same function at the same time. So we also do that, but I'd say the majority is self-based.
Related to that, one of the big themes in online education has been completion rates. You know, if I go back a while, let's say 2011, 2012 or so, when the MOOCs were the talk of the town, Coursera, etc., and, you know, all these courses being available all over the world, but the completion rates were, you know, sub 20% for pretty much all of them at that time. How have you cracked that completion rates question to get people to finish the course?
It's a complex problem. Obviously, it depends on the level of your program. It depends on your intake population. If you select them very strictly, it's easier to have higher completion rates as well. It depends on student outcomes and what do they get at the end. If there is a very strong incentive for them to finish, they are more likely to finish. It depends on your pedagogy, the level of support and student success services that you offer. So what we try to build is all of the above. So we want to make sure that we provide great orientation. We're trying not to send students to a program where they're unlikely to succeed and there is no outcome for them. And, you know, so we're going to redirect them towards a program that is more tailored to them. Then we provide a lot of student success services. So we have teams making sure that if they're running behind, we're going to reach out proactively, try and understand what's going on and work on a remediation plan with them. Sometimes it means like switching mentors. Sometimes it means like building on methodology with them, et cetera, et cetera.
Sorry to interrupt you there, Pierre. When someone is behind, those first sort of prompts, is that automated or is that an actual person on the other side?
It's both. If it's slow, running behind by like 5 or 10%, that's going to be automated. And we'll reach out automatically to the student, say, you're running slightly behind, like what's going on, et cetera. Do you need more resources? What is the problem? When it starts to be wider, the gap, it becomes wider, then we have a student success agent from our team reaching out to the student, having kind of an interview with them and saying, okay, what's going on? And every case is different. It could be they have like health issues, financial issues. It could be doesn't work with their mentor. It could be like they're completely lost. It could be motivational. And so we try and fix that with a mix of AI and human support.
Yeah. In this age of AI, and I mean, we're still yet to fully see its impacts. I believe that what you're describing now, which is the motivational side of having a human on the other side who believes in you, backs yeah. you, wants you to succeed, is actually going to become increasingly important in the world of education.
Definitely. Yeah, I think the mentorship piece is super critical. Like every week you have somebody to report to and not just like a robot, you know? Yeah. And that is important. That being said, AI can really like accelerate learning and provide like really value add at scale as well. So I think the combination of the two is really interesting. And the last point I think on completion rate is really finding a job. We do those things called apprenticeship programs where it's a work and study program. You're hired from day one. You're getting paid while you learn on Open Classrooms. You're going to be on the job 4 days a week and you're going to be trained by Open Classrooms 1 day a week. That is gold. This is driving completion rates of 80 to 90% because people are getting paid from day one. Tuition fees are covered by the employer. And since they already have a job, they have a really strong incentive to complete the program. If they don't complete the program, they'll lose their job. At the same time. So they'll get a degree, they'll get a high-paying job. This is, I think, the most innovative, comprehensive program that we offer. And it also drives the highest student outcomes in the form of completion rate, graduation rate, and job placement rate.
That's wonderful. That's absolutely wonderful. And yes, I can see how that would be a very strong incentive to finish the task at hand. And if I move on then to the content side of this. So I guess the content is on two sides. There's what the corporates want their future employees to learn, and there's also what the students themselves want to learn. So maybe just on the content side, what are some of the big categories? What are people wanting to learn?
So for us, our point of view on that is we want to fulfill employers' needs, and we want to start from the job market. So we analyze job market data in terms of job posting, the imbalance of supply and demand on those jobs, and what kind of skills are behind those jobs. So right now, for example, you have in tech and IT, you'll have jobs like AI or cybersecurity and data that are still pretty hot. But all the jobs really decreased and lost steam. Like for example, software development was very hot 4 or 5 years ago, and now not so much. Healthcare is a really strong category with a lot of unfulfilled job postings right now. Energy jobs, manufacturing, supply chain, sales, etc. So this is how we choose to invest in one of all the other categories, and then how we build our curriculum with the skills in high demand. So we want to build exactly the curriculum matching the demand by employers. Sometimes students want to study something different, and that's great. But we are here in the business of placing people in the workforce. So we want to focus on employers' needs. And then from there, we build our own content. So we have learning designers, we have studio, we build our own videos, we have our own accreditation in Europe, in Africa, in the US, and we own the IP from A to Z. So you'll see like unique content, really high quality content. We use also AI to generate this content in text, in videos, etc. And we invest in new categories and field of study years after years to cover more and more employers' needs.
And I can see, taking all of what you've said in totality, that the experience here will be very, very, very different to a traditional university where some of the degrees haven't changed in 200 years. But they're fundamentally doing, you know, it's something quite different. So they're training people effectively for academia rather than for the job market specifically. So that's wonderful. And thanks for that overview. On the distribution side, and this comes back a little bit to who you described as your clients. So how does this tangibly work? Do you have a sales force that is out getting building relationships with employers, and that's how you sort of distribute, so to speak, or market your product?
So we have employer sales. We sell to small and medium-sized businesses as well as enterprise clients. So I mentioned, for example, like Merck is a client, Amazon, Capgemini, AXA, BNP, Cisco, etc. So we train, upskill, reskill the employees, and we build new talent pipelines in the form of apprenticeship programs, like I said, work and study program, especially on skills and jobs in high demand. So right now, think of, you know, AI, cyber, healthcare, etc. We also sell to governments. So that is more public bidding processes, RFPs, where we then train unemployed or underemployed, underserved populations to help them get the skills they need to find a job. And finally, we also sell directly to students. We need to attract students to our platform. That part is actually interesting because with this apprenticeship product, we can pitch something extremely compelling to students. You can get a college degree, fully accredited, for free, debt-free. You're getting paid while you learn, and you have a job from day one. That is almost too good to be true. So it's fairly easy to attract students at a much lower cost of acquisition in terms of marketing. We also provide free online courses. So we have kind of a MOOC side of our platform. Yeah. And that freemium model also attracts a lot of candidates. So in that regard, we have a pretty strong marketing engine to attract students into our programs.
And one, I'd begin to learn a little bit more. A lot of the clients that you mentioned, Amazon, Merck, a lot of global businesses in there. Do these relationships tend to be in a given geography? So you'll be serving Amazon in, pick a country, in France, let's say, or does that also go across borders?
Can be both. Depends on the corporation, but we do have like global contracts as well. Enterprise sales is complicated, right? Even if you have a global contract, usually you start distributing more in details, like country by country, region by region, function, department by department, business unit by business unit. So we have the mix of two. Obviously, B2G are usually, you know, country specific. It's regulated. You need licenses, you need accreditation, certifications, and so on. So to sell really efficiently in a given market, you have to be in the market.
Got it. All right. That's a fascinating tour. I'm keen then for us to move a little bit to AI and technology, and let's have some fun on this section. So two questions there related to that. So just in big picture, because you've touched on it in some places, how are you incorporating AI and technology into the way that you run your business today? And more importantly, what are you excited about looking forward?
Yeah, we use AI at honestly all levels within the organization and our product. So I mentioned, for example, we use Gen AI to create new content, to update our content. It could be in text, could be in video. In 2 years' time, we decrease our content production cost by about 60 to 70% using AI.
Wow.
We use AI to answer about 30% of our customer support tickets. So like one chance out of three that you're going to have an answer to your demand in about 5 minutes by AI agent. We use AI to build what we call a companion. Companion is this AI-powered assistant on the platform to help students in between mentorship sessions. So if they have a question, they're stuck on the project, they don't understand something, then they can ask this AI agent companion and get an answer very quickly. We're investing more and more in that. We see that
Does it have a name, student, yeah?
Companion, yeah.
It's called Companion. Okay, got it.
Yeah.
Got it.
Okay. And this AI is really interesting because we see that students who use that the most will succeed about 10 to 20% faster than students not using it. So there is great impact behind it. We use AI for enrollment and admissions. So now we have this real-time direct admissions funnel. It means that where for most students, about 70 to 80% of our applications, you will be admitted right away. We'll tell you, you're admitted here. We're going to recommend you a program. We're going to help you with financial aid as well. And all of that is automated using AI. So I can go on. I mean, and the impact of AI in our product, in our organization, has been really amazing to witness. I think there's much more to come. I think what I'm excited about is really this tool to provide quality education at scale and individualized education. And that is new, right? Because we know that, you know, one-on-one mentorship, for example, works really well with, you know, Benjamin Bloom's research. We know that it drives higher student outcomes. But the question has always been, can you do that at scale at, you know, efficient cost, really? And that is changing with AI. I believe that in the next, you know, 2 years, we'll be able to generate individualized curriculum and say, Emily, I'm going to teach you cybersecurity in the context of education, investment, and financial world, et cetera, because this is what you're after. And have like courses tailored for you, and that is only possible using AI. It's not something that we could have done before.
Yeah, that's wonderful to hear, and I get excited just listening to you talk about it. As you say, it's almost been like mythical, the fact of going back to an education where you have individualized tutors, you know, as it started before it sort of became a more industrialized and mass market product. And for the first time in definitely in my lifetime, that seems like something that will be on the horizon, that will be realistic during the course of our lifetimes, with the role of a human, as we said, in things like motivation, the mentorship, etc. So I share your excitement and enthusiasm for the impact that it's going to have on education broadly and in higher education specifically, which has just become so expensive. I mean, in the part of the world where you are now, finding a degree for less than $100,000, you know, is hard work. It's just it's not sustainable in the long term. Okay, if I move across a little bit then to the investor side of this business. So, you know, I mentioned up front when I was introducing you that Open Classrooms is backed by some great institutional investors, General Atlantic, Lumos, Salesforce Ventures, Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, and others as well. So how would you verbalize the investment case? What do you think is the appeal for investors of online education?
So I think education has always been, you know, an attractive sector that is long-term, it's very stable. Every everybody needs education in all regions. In some countries, this is actually the largest market. It is a very significant market. Usually, you know, in a country like the US, think about the accredited Title IV market. So public funded by the federal government, that's $120 billion a year right now. And wow. That's just public funding at federal level. So significant size of the market. It's still developing. There's still growth through demography as well. And at the same time, this market is shifting from in-person to online. Obviously, COVID accelerated that trend. And we had like a peak in 2020, 2021. It went back to more in-person afterwards, but still continuing on this journey, transitioning from in-person to online. Now in the US, the majority of higher education students are online. The majority. That's a big change. 20 years ago, mostly it was in-person, like campuses, physical facilities, etc. Now it is online. So huge market. Yeah, it's I mean, it's kind amazing. Of mind-blowing because when you think about it, it means so many different things. It means also that the type of students change. Yeah. Now, the average student in higher education in the U.S. is not 18 years old or 19 years old and, you know, going to frat houses and things like that. No, that's not it. It's actually somebody
trying to buy some alcohol.
Exactly. That's kind of like the image that we have when we think about a college student, right? No, that's not it anymore. Now, actually, the average student is in their 30s. They had like 10 years of work experience and they want to have a better job. And they have maybe a family. They have a mortgage. They want something flexible. So it's really, really different nowadays. But this growing market shifting to online is obviously very attractive to investors. I have to say that there was a huge growth during COVID for obvious reasons towards, you know, online education that has slowed down now. So I would say, generally speaking, online education and education technology is running a little bit lower in the cycle right now when it comes to investments and capital markets. That being said, I think the fundamentals of this market are still very strong and still kind of growing towards online education. So I believe that in the next few years, it's going to come back and it's kind of through a correction after amazing growth in COVID years.
Okay. That's lovely. That's a great investment case. And I read your mission report prior to this conversation. I saw that you have a mission committee. So clearly social impact and mission and purpose is something that's important to you and you spend a lot of time on. It was very clear reading that report. You've taken, you know, you track a lot of metrics and you've taken quite a strong approach to it. So just why? Why is it important to you? Why do you spend so much time on it?
Well, I think it's back to our roots, you know, why we build this. We didn't build it to build a company. We built it to create the best courses. We built it because we wanted the, you know, other types of classes and pedagogy. We built the classes which we had in school. That's why we built it. We didn't build it to IPO with venture capital behind us and so on. That's not the intent. It was always about making social impact, making a dent and helping people. So we built the company as a mission-driven company. We're a public benefit corporation. We're B Corp certified. And we are laser focused on student outcomes and social impact across all of our stakeholders, including employers, governments, etc. So how do we track that? We track that in the form of, you know, graduation rate, job placement rate, but also in terms of the type of students that we serve. We want to provide quality education and quality jobs to people who need it the most, who don't have access to quality education right now. So we define several categories of populations that are our target. Think of unemployed, underemployed populations, people living in underserved areas, individuals with disabilities, refugees, students with a lower level of qualification, like school dropouts, et cetera, et cetera. So we're very intentional towards those populations. We want to train most of our students in one of those categories, because this is how we think we would serve and fulfill our mission to make education accessible, making it accessible to people who don't have access to education right now. So this is how we were intentional about it. And last year, we trained and we placed about 42,000 students in the workforce. So to us, it's not just about training the person, giving them a degree. It's about making sure that they had a socioeconomic mobility out of it. So we want to make sure that they got uplifted in their life thanks to Open Classrooms.
That's a beautiful way to end the conversation on Open Classrooms, and it's been really energizing for me, taking all of it together. The mission, with the way you use technology, the items that are different and innovative about Open Classrooms. So thanks for sharing that and about your journey. So I'm going to come back down then to you specifically and away from Open Classrooms. So back to Pierre. And I ask the same concluding questions in all of my conversations. And that is simply, please tell us about one of your favorite teachers or educators.
My favorite teacher is actually very close to me, is my co-founder. I think meeting Mathieu online, because we met online through the website he created, Mercedes-O, back then in early 2000, when we were both in middle school. Mathieu is an extremely talented teacher. He can write a course, tell you a story, and you'll be captivated. You will understand everything. It's very accessible. And the success of Open Classrooms like really came from that gift and skill set that he has. He's probably one of the most popular teachers in France right now. And because of all of the online courses he built with literally like millions of students. So I think it's very inspiring to see how one teacher can have an impact now using technology on literally millions of people and a very, very significant impact. So people would, you know, come up to him and thank him for the impact that he had on their life, even though like he's like, I don't know you, but it's nice to be here. So very, very inspiring. And I think it's been, you know, part of my own journey, obviously, since I was a teenager being Open Classrooms.
That is wonderful. That's a great tribute to Mathieu, and I hope he does get to listen to this as well. And you're giving him such a fitting and wonderful tribute. So, Pierre, it's been really a joy having you on here today. I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation, and I'll be seeing you soon, actually, out there in the US. I'll give you a shout when I'm there. Thank you so much for coming in and joining us today.
Thank you so much for your time, your questions. It's been lovely.